please.
Case of Terry. Is it pronounced Stinney?
Yes, Your Honor.
Stinney versus the Commonwealth. We're ready when you are, sir.
Judge, may it please the court. I'm Dan Mazzio on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Stinney. If I could reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
3 minutes, yes, sir.
Mr. Mazzio, so I don't interrupt your flow of things,
yes, sir,
momentarily, can I go over a couple things with you at the
Certainly.
Outset? Am I of correct understanding here that on your client's best day, and that's including the 194 days that you assign as error to the trial court, that you would claim going under the 273-day statutory speedy trial period, that 294 days elapsed? Is that your best day on this?
I think that's correct, Judge. I think that would be our position. I think there are essentially two time periods at issue with different days attached. But yes, I think if everything were assigned to the Commonwealth, I believe that's my math as well.
And the two periods at issue, I'm sorry.
So,
go ahead.
So with that in mind, obviously the lengthier period is the 194 days that goes between the trial date of January 27th and July 19th of 2016, the one that the court has attributed to your client and you find to be error. Am I correct on that?
Yes, I think it might actually be, depending on the court's ruling, I think the Attorney General is going to argue that there's actually a shorter period from the February the 8th. Yes, but yes, that's one of those periods. And then the second, which I didn't address initially in my brief, but which the Attorney General reference had to do with the initial setting of the jury trial date.
And that was not initially, that has not been calculated against your client to this point, correct?
That issue was never raised,
prior
to the Attorney General's response, that's correct.
Because you had an initial trial date of May 29th of 2015, correct?
Correct.
And then your client in April asked for a jury, so it got continued from May 29th to July 9th of 2015, is that right?
I would suggest, Judge, it was set for that date, but yes, I think that the procedure is correct. Yes, that's what occurred.
And the case law reflects that when the defendant asks for a jury, that any delay between the original trial date and the time it's reset with the jury counts against the defendant. Am I right on that?
Judge, I'm not familiar with the case that says that specifically. I know that there are other things that have been specifically assigned as motions, things that need to be considered by the trial judge that would.
Well, wouldn't it stand to reason that if the defendant asks for a jury and that necessitates, originally set as a bench trial, the defendant decides he wants a jury and that necessitates a continuance, wouldn't that stand to reason that time would be calculated against the defendant?
Well, I have a couple thoughts on that, Your Honor. I think one of them is that I think that it might be a more difficult case. My argument might be more difficult to make in a situation where the defendant walked in on the day of trial and said that he wanted a jury trial requiring some rearrangement as such. But I think that what happened in this case is that far in advance of trial, there was a pretrial hearing date just for these exact purposes to determine if everything was on schedule, at which point the necessity of a jury, the defendant exercised that right. And I think at that point, if we're going to say that that's charged to the defendant, it sort of puts the defense counsel in an impossible position at that point in order to insist that they will not set a date by which the court may have juries available, but instead will only allow that trial date that was initially set and probably not planned for with a jury to be the only date for the purposes of speedy trial.
No, what it does is it makes you engage in a balance. Do I want a jury enough for that 41 days, for example, to count against me? And if so, I recognize that it might not affect any other dates in the future, but that 41 days counts against me. And at the time, speedy trial wasn't even anywhere near an issue. But I guess getting to my point, where if the law reflects that 41 days needs to be counted against your client, doesn't that make everything else moot in this case?
It does, Judge. I would concede that. I think if the court were to rule that is counted against my client, then yes, the math doesn't work anymore on the speedy trial argument. I take the position that that's not the case, but I would agree with your assessment in that situation.
Understood. Thank you for indulging me.
Yes, Judge. And I'll just follow up on that, if I would, while we're talking about it, Your Honor. I think the second issue has to do, what would make this, again, more difficult is if the jury trial date that was then selected was outside of what would have been the speedy trial limits in this particular case. But I think it's important as it relates to this particular issue to note the orders that the court enters as it relates to those two settings of the case. They appear on page 39 and page 14 of the record. They're identical, and neither one of them say continuance. They say set this matter for trial on such and such date. And I would argue that the setting of the jury trial is at that point is no different than the initial setting of the trial date, which is done at the point at which the court first makes that determination. That time period is not calculated against the criminal defendant. So we walk in, we agree to a trial date, it's 4.5 months out, it doesn't violate speedy trial. That period of time is charged to the Commonwealth.
But certainly that's not the initial trial date. I mean, everybody would agree with that, wouldn't you? That July 9th date is not the initial trial date as contemplated under the statute.
Correct. There was initially a trial date set in that May time frame. Yes. Aaron, good.
No problem. So do you have any case law to support your position? I know that you didn't file a reply brief. Do you have any case law that supports your proposition that that time period does not inure against the defendant?
Well, Judge, I suppose I don't specifically today. I don't believe there's a case that says I'm correct. I would argue, at least unless I'm not aware, I don't think there's a case that specifically says I'm incorrect in this issue. I think in taking your point, Judge Alley, about the balancing test, I think it would be unfair to put a defendant in a situation to have to balance their right to be tried by a jury and also their right to be tried within the speedy trial frame as time frame as contemplated by the statute, and to have to make a decision as to whether or not they'd like to have both of those rights at the same time. I think it puts us in a little bit of a tricky position from a practical standpoint and a logical standpoint as we're approaching the initial setting of cases in court, as we're contemplating whether or not we can reasonably agree to any time frames. And that's, I suppose, the difficulty in general when it comes to the actual practical day-to-day issues with trying to preserve a client's speedy trial rights, or is that it's not entirely clear what needs to be done in order to preserve that right. I think that we know that there can't be a concurrence by defense counsel in a continuance really of any kind. What exactly that means day in and day out, I think, is a little bit more confusing. So by the court's suggestion that would be the case, so that's to suggest that by electing at any point after that first day of arraignment when the initial trial date was set, by electing a jury trial, the court could then have set, in theory, the case 4 years out over the objection of defense counsel, and that would have been charged to the defendant for the purpose of speedy trial, and the answer would have been, well, that's just unlucky. You elected to have a jury trial. You should have taken that bench trial date. I think that gets to be a little bit unreasonable when you start to think about the practical consequences.
Well, and frankly, that's not going to happen either, where you select a date 4 years out, absent concurrence of counsel.
And I'm exaggerating a little bit for purposes of the argument, but I do practice in a jurisdiction where 8 months to a year is not an unusual time frame to set a jury trial date, and so...
But that's not what this was. And speedy trial wasn't waived completely. It was just arguably for that 41-day period between May 29th and July 9th. So the defendant didn't have to give up speedy trial in order to have that, because it was all still contemplated well within the... what would have been a speedy trial time frame, because it was very early on in this case.
And I would suggest, Judge, that by exercising a constitutional right to be tried by a jury, by setting that jury well prior to trial date and within the statutory time frame that would still be within the speedy trial time frame, I think that there is an implicit assertion that the client is not waiving their speedy trial rights. I don't know why in that particular situation the individual would want to do that. I think again, from a practical standpoint, as we start watching that issue play out, it essentially gives. The reality here is that if, according to the Attorney General's position, according to the position of the Commonwealth, this offense occurred in August of 2014. It's eventually tried in July of 2016. There are a bunch of procedural wranglings in the middle, but they're saying 41 days of that time is all that's charged to the Commonwealth. So everything else that's happened in this case, that's all on Mr. Stinney. We've got 41 days during this two-year period that we're going to charge the Commonwealth for the purposes of statutory speedy trial. And I think that's just unreasonable under the circumstances. I think I understand the court's question, and I do think there are times when it would be reasonable to charge a request on behalf of the defendant to the defendant for purposes of speedy trial. I think if there was not a possibility to set that case reasonably within the initial speedy trial deadline, I think if the Commonwealth was taking issue and wanting the defendant to explicitly waive speedy trial on the record at that point for the purposes of that time frame. I think if there was something that absolutely necessitated an opportunity or a situation where you had to go outside of that time frame, I think there are certainly examples where there could be a waiver. But I think to suggest that any time a person, a defendant, elects to try their case by way of jury, that they are forced to make a decision to then automatically waive for purposes of speedy trial any time frame it takes to get that jury set, even if it's still within the window, I think would be unreasonable in practice.
But Mr. Mazzia, let me, and if I was good with math, I'd have gone to medical school. So let me just say that right up front. My understanding, though, is that the period of time the defendant requested the jury trial.
Correct.
It was set for a jury trial that would have still been within speedy trial. Is that correct?
Correct.
So in your context, it was still within the speedy trial zone to have that jury trial. There were then these other things that happened. And I guess based on Judge Atlee's question, that period, it would be maybe a different scenario if the judge had set the jury trial for outside the speedy trial.
I think that would be a much
time period.
Different question, yes.
I think it would be.
Then there would have been, had to be certainly some discussion of how the defendant reacted to that process and what the events were. But I think I take the position that setting that trial for a jury trial on that initial pretrial conference date was no different than setting it for trial initially, that there was the court's orders even reflect that in the way that the language that they use, it's no different. It says set for trial. It doesn't say continued. It doesn't say that the matter was continued on motion of one of the parties or that there was an affirmance or an objection of any kind. It just says that it was set for trial. I think that's the reasonable way to handle that situation when it comes to speedy trial. I think as long as it's still set on a date that works for the Commonwealth within the window, there's no disadvantage to the Commonwealth in that case, nor should, frankly, from my perspective, that disadvantage necessarily be considered as it relates to Mr. Stinney's right to statutory speedy trial. I'm running through my time very quickly, and I haven't gotten to what was initially the central issue in my brief. I think that I disagree with the Attorney General's perspective and the court's ruling that Mr. Stinney did, in fact, waive his right by selecting the date that eventually became the trial date. I think that the case was finally tried on. I think it was clear that the court had intended to charge that period of time to the Commonwealth for purposes of speedy trial. I don't think it's reasonable to suggest that the court only intended to charge the less than 2-week period between the January date and the February date when there eventually was a trial date selected to the Commonwealth. I think it's much more reasonable that the entire period it took during that time was charged to the Commonwealth for these purposes. I think the Commonwealth attorney in this case expresses many, many times that she was well aware that there was, in fact, a speedy trial issue, that the defendant had not waived his speedy trial rights, that she was up against a clock. I would suggest for the purposes of this case, Judge, that there is no suggestion, setting aside the court's conversations and questions about the initial setting of that jury trial, I don't think there's ever any sort of suggestion from the Commonwealth at any stage that was, in fact, a period which should have told that would have been charged to the defendant. That was not a period of time where he had maintained his speedy trial rights, and I would suggest that it is the burden of the Commonwealth to show that the speedy trial timeline was followed appropriately, and that by not raising that issue later, I would suggest that the Commonwealth in this particular case was essentially conceding that purpose for the first section of time when the jury trial was set was, in fact, charged to the Commonwealth for the purposes of speedy trial. And
when you say the Commonwealth, you're saying the Commonwealth's attorney below?
Yes, correct. At the multiple different appearances that were made and speedy trial was discussed, there was never a suggestion that time frame was, as defense counsel at trial and pretrial hearings recounted the speedy trial timeline and calculated that as being told to the Commonwealth, there was never any disagreement from the Commonwealth at any of those hearings. And I will now attempt to retain my minute of time here for rebuttal.
All right, thank you. Ms. Bourne?
Ms. Bourne, I have it in my feeble mind that there was a case that talked about if the defendant requests a continuance for purpose of...
There was an unpublished case, which I cited on brief, okay. In the Supreme Court of Virginia. And so the issue here is Well, really two things. First of all, let me address Rosemary Bourne on behalf of the Commonwealth of Virginia.
Sorry, short circuit there.
But let me first address this issue of somehow the Commonwealth waived this argument by not presenting it below. And, of course, this court, the burden is on him at this juncture on appeal to show that the trial court abused its discretion and that there was an error of law. And if there are factual issues, I'm sorry, in dispute, then made a factual error, which would have to be plainly wrong. So that's his burden on appeal. And, of course, this court, when reviewing error, can rely on the entire record. It's not one where the contemporaneous objection rule applies to the Commonwealth in that context. And so for that reason, I think the entire record is open for this court to be able to calculate correctly the speedy trial rights. Now, with regard to your concern, Judge Decker, I disagree that this is the same thing as an initial trial date. And the reason is, when we look at Howard versus Commonwealth, Commonwealth versus Hutchins, and Heath versus Commonwealth, it's clear. And one of the reasons that it needs to be clear is because of all these cases that have come up recently where people are having such difficulty deciding when the time has run. And that's why the rules have to be clear, so that the Commonwealth can calculate when its time has run. And what those cases in totem say is that the initial trial date, whether it's set, if it's set outside and there's an agreement that it's set outside the speedy trial time, then that counts against the defendant because he's on notice at that time that he's set it outside. When that initial trial date, however, is scheduled inside, that's the first thing in that initial period of time between either the preliminary hearing or the indictment or when the indictment is served, that initial trial date is counted against the Commonwealth. Now, that initial trial date here, there was counsel present in court, and he was standing in for Mr. Mazzio. And so the defendant had counsel, he was in court, and he asked for a bench trial. At that moment, he could have asked for a jury trial, but he didn't.
Well, I thought that at that hearing, the counsel who had stepped in said that we probably will want a jury, but we can agree to this date for now, something to that effect.
Well, I'm looking at appendix page 9, which is where I think this took place. And my reading of that is that he's asked me to set this for trial in May and to request a bond hearing. And so, therefore, it's set for trial in May, and there was a bond hearing that was going to occur prior to that May hearing. And then it was set for a bench trial.
So it's the position of the Commonwealth then that it was set for a bench trial, and then when the defense came back and said, we want a jury trial date, that gets counted against them because they've changed their mind?
Because it's because it's not an initial trial date. The initial trial date's already been set for May 29th.
Well, in order for the math to work, as the Commonwealth is advocating here, doesn't there have to be a waiver? This is the constitutional right of a trial by a jury. Are you suggesting that was waived at the initial
Well, when he says I'm setting it for a bench trial, and he has counsel present in order to do that,
constitutes a waiver of a.
I don't think it's I would disagree that the issue should be conflated whether there's a waiver of jury trial and whether there's an initial trial date for the purposes of speedy trial. And so here, there's an initial trial date. It's set by counsel. With the judge at a bench trial.
And because of that, there's no dispute that the time frame between March 11th of 2015 and May 29th, which would have been the original trial date, that's a time period, 70-some-odd days, I think, that counts against the Commonwealth.
Yes, I agree with that. But then he came in and asked for a jury after he had already agreed to an initial trial date. And it's my position, and I think that the law under those cases I just cited to you, Howard, Hutchins, and Heath, says actually after the initial trial date, anything else has to be considered a continuance. And why? So we have clarity. So we know that, therefore, any new dates that are set for trial have to be attributed to somebody. And that there's not confusion about when these things go outside of speedy trial.
And so your point is, because it's a continuance, it's treated as a continuance, and it's at the request of the defendant,
That's correct.
That tolls the time.
Yes, Your Honor. That's exactly my position, that it's a continuance, that it's requested by the defendant. And when the cases discuss the reasons why continuances are either attributable to the defendant or not and whether they move speedy trial, they say things like, well, a motion in limine, which could be heard on the actual trial date, which could be heard on that actual date, will not change anything because, you know, there's no necessity to have a new date. But clearly there was a necessity here, or they would have heard the jury trial on May 29th.
To say, we wouldn't be talking about this issue if the court said, okay, May 29th is now trial by jury instead of a bench trial.
That's exactly right. They, by necessity, had to move it. And, you know, there are remedies for defendants who have, if not that it happened in this case or even close to happen in this case, but if it were 4 years out and there's not a statutory speedy trial violation, there certainly is a constitutional speedy trial violation that they could raise. So there are remedies in place by both the Constitution and by the statute there to allow people to raise objections to this. So I disagree that we're going to have this deluge of cases wherein people are coming in, you know, these jury trials are going to be going 4 years down the road and the defendant doesn't have any remedy. I will say that what more often happens is that people wait until the very end and then ask for a jury trial, and then everybody's scrambling to try to get this matter cleaned up.
The concern would be is if you turn this into the Wild West and give everybody a chance to use speedy trial as a sword rather than a shield.
Exactly. That's the problem. Now, if the court has any other questions for me about that particular issue, I'm happy to answer them, but I do think I need to move on to my more troublesome issue, which I think is regarding this continuance. But what I would say is that the case cited Harvey that is relied on by my opposing counsel does, well, first of all, it's en banc. It's a nullity at this juncture. And so I don't even think it can be relied on for precedential value at this juncture because it's en banc, and that means it's vacated. Nonetheless, even if this court could consider that as controlling authority in this case, it doesn't control this case. It's distinguishable factually. And the reason is he says, well, I think we can understand what the court really intended to do. No, the reason we know what the court intended to do in this case is because the court said what he intended. He said it when he drafted his order, and the order says by agreement of the parties. That the matter was scheduled by agreement of the parties. And that order, which I attached to an addendum to my brief, it is a controlling and it waives speedy trial.
What's the date? Is that the February 8th?
It is, and it was said it was a bond order in the record, and I apologize for not putting it in the appendix, but when I went through this very massive file and looking through the doing the designation, when it said bond order, I reduced its significance in my own mind, and it turned out it actually is a continuance order and was mislabeled. And it did address some bond issues, but it also says, by agreement, this matter is set for July 19th and 20th at 9 a.m., and the date of this order is February 8th.
But at the February 8th hearing, wasn't that the hearing where defense counsel said, I'm not waiving speedy trial?
He said it, but the court didn't put it in the order. And then when the court was interpreting its own order, he also said some other things, which were, my client's not here, and I'm okay with that date that we've set it on, but my client's not here, so but the bar tells me essentially I can't agree to waive. I mean, this is the sort of using speedy trial as a sword that I would argue is a problem when you say I'm not ready to go on the one hand, I can't set a date any earlier on the one hand, but on the other hand, I'm not waiving.
But if the defense counsel says I'm not waiving speedy trial, but yes, I have that date, we can make that date work. Don't we need to be mindful that we want to encourage counsel to agree to a trial date, preserve your point, speedy trial, and then do what you can on the calendar?
But the statute says that if you agree, if you acquiesce to a date outside the speedy trial, unless you say I want my rights right now, if you acquiesce to that, then you have waived your speedy trial right. I mean, you've waived it as to that time period. You haven't done a waiver, which is like forevermore, but you've
it tolls.
It tolls. And
so you're saying the order trumps the whatever confusing argument there was below.
I do, because look, first of all, this is, and the other issue with the Harvey case is that there was a lot of this, well, this was one judge, and then Judge Weckstein was trying to interpret this Judge Carson's order, and he couldn't possibly know what Judge Carson meant because he wasn't there, et cetera, et cetera. This was all one judge who was interpreting his own order and what happened in his own courtroom.
So your position is, in order to preserve speedy trial, it's not enough to say, I'm not waiving speedy trial. You have to then fold your arms and say, and I'm not agreeing to any other trial date.
Well, I'm saying that you have to say, I want to exercise my right, and I want to have this case heard within the speedy trial date.
I.e., Judge, I'm available on that date, but I would object to it being set that far out.
Right. Because right here, the Commonwealth was trying, albeit ineffectively, to try to get this matter moved up. And we have opposing counsel saying, I don't think there's good cause for a null pros, meaning I don't think she's calculated this speedy trial correctly. Apparently nobody understood what the actual... I mean, these are complicated things to try to figure out while you're standing in trial, to try to figure out exactly how many days have passed and et cetera. So I don't hold it against anybody that they can't figure it out at that very moment without pulling out all of these orders and doing a count. They were sort of talking... broadly about, well, we think that it's within or it's already passed or I'm concerned, and she was doing her best to try to get the matter moved up and trying to null pros it if she couldn't because she was concerned by looking at the time periods that it was moving outside the speedy trial time frame. And you know, the judge did give her a smack on the wrist for that short period of time for, like, messing up the indictments or whatnot through her office, but not for the entire time. I think the court, in interpreting its own orders, then said, well, look, your client wasn't here. We couldn't set the time. That was a factor in this. We couldn't even pick a date because your client wasn't in court. And so because of that, I would argue we look at the order. The court speaks through its orders. If we can't figure out what's going on in the order, then yes, sure, it's fine to go back and look at the transcript. But the court here interpreted its own order, interpreted what happened, and it said, this is what I intended, this is what I think happened. And for that reason, I would ask you to affirm, unless the court has any further questions for me. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Mazzio?
No, I don't have too much time, but it's very rare that I get to make an argument at the appellate level that the Commonwealth had a duty to do something that was their duty entirely and that my client should not be held to be responsible. But that's the situation we find ourselves in here. It is their duty, the Commonwealth's duty, to try this case within the parameters of statutory speedy trial. And it's not hard. They have an opportunity at any point in the process. Unfortunately, I don't know, it doesn't make sense to me personally, but they can null pros the case and re-indict and start all over at any time that they want to. I think in this particular case, to charge Mr. Stinney, to suggest Mr. Stinney, you waived your speedy trial right because you wanted to have a jury trial. You did it exactly the right way. You came in well before trial so that there was no issues getting the date set. But unfortunately, the court sets trial dates differently for bench trials and jury trials. You can't just decide you're going to have a jury on that particular date. So now you've waived your speedy trial rights because you wanted to exercise your constitutional...
Or you've allowed it to toll. Not necessarily.
Well, for that period of time, at least, you have waived that particular right. Those are days that you no longer have an opportunity to have your case tried and are instead forced to wait. I think that that would be unfair in that situation. I think it's, again, unfair later to say, well, yes, the judge said this was going to be charged to the Commonwealth. We went to court. We insisted that although we were available on this date, that we were not waiving your speedy trial rights. Well, you should have gotten it actually in the order. Even though that's not something that has been necessarily specifically litigated or laid out before, it was contemplated. There's some discussion of it in the Harvey case. I would agree that case still pending makes it a little bit more difficult to rely on, but that was not a known entity. So what we're talking about is, again, sorry, Mr. Stinney, this is your fault again. Attorney General suggests that there was a slap on the wrist for filing an incorrect indictment. It was much more significant than that. There was a charge of rape that was pending for more than a year when there was never an allegation that a rape had occurred. That's why the judge made the decision he did. It's why it was charged to the Commonwealth. I don't think that simply because there's not the language not waiving your speedy trial rights in the court's order suggests that it didn't happen. I think the interpretation of the court's orders is important when we're talking about what did the court rule. I think it's a little bit more of a distinction when we're talking about what occurred. When the court's order is reflecting what occurred at a hearing, I would suggest that's much different than when the court order is reflecting what a judge ruled on a particular issue. I would suggest both of these issues, from practical, logical standpoints, should be charged to the Commonwealth, and as such, that was a violation of Mr. Stinney's rights.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We will come down and greet counsel, and that will conclude the document.